interview in front of Kristen on June 30th, 1986, in San Rafael, California. This is our third interview. And we're just about to get you through college.
How about please?
Okay. Now, you had come back from Mariposa. This was a summer, the summer before your senior year that you...
Yes, I think it was the summer before. It wasn't the summer, it was in midterm.
Oh, I see, this was during...
Because it was only a long weekend that we had this field trip.
And you had already met Fran, had you?
Yes.
But she wasn't teaching at Mariposa at that time?
No, not at that time, no.
It was just a coincidence that she went there later.
That's right.
I see.
In fact, jobs were pretty scarce in that time of the period of our...
Yes, this was the beginning of the Depression then, wasn't it?
Right.
And did this affect the mining in California greatly?
Oh, no. Because mining in California was principally gold. And because it was gold mining, it was after the price of gold was raised from $20.67 to $35 an ounce, then the gold mines really were in boom time because of the higher price.
Now that came, as I recall, in 33?
Yeah, I had
well,
that.
We can look that up anyway, but...
Yeah, that's in my little book.
Did this affect your choice of career at all, to go into gold?
No, because gold was still, in 1931, was still $20.67, and the mines were operating, all of them that I know of, were operating, but not too lucrative.
Perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit about how you made your career decision when you finished college, and
knowing that graduation was coming up in May of 1931, I thought it prudent to look for a job. So I asked F.W. Bradley of Bradley Mining Company.
This is Fred.
Fred Bradley, for an interview, which he kindly consented. And he mentioned that they were bringing into production a mine called the Spanish, about 30 miles northwest of northeast of Nevada City.
Okay. Now, how did you know about Fred Bradley?
Because I knew, due to the fact that I knew Worthen, who was out of college, and I had met him, and Jim Bradley, a very good friend, and Phil Bradley and Hank Bradley, their two cousins of the, they were the sons of Phil Bradley, who was a partner and brother to F.W. Bradley. So going to school with Jim, I had stayed at his home in San Francisco on an occasion or two, when we had a night out during our school year. So I was able to get this interview with F.W. Bradley, Fred Bradley, and he said if I would like to go to the Spanish mine, why, he could offer me a job, and Jim was going as manager, which surprised me somewhat because I never knew he had done any work at all in mining, although he was from a mining family. I also had an interview with the Gould and Company, who were Quicksilver miners. And knew Gould.
There was somebody named Layard.
No.
No.
And knew the Gould. I don't know his name. His first name. I did then. We were very, very good friends. And
Gould.
No.
This is New Almaden.
Well, they had. They were the top producers of quicksilver in the state of California. And Mr. Gould, the senior of the Gould Company, offered me a job to go to work at New Almaden, but however, I postponed a decision on that. And the third interview was with Ben Gett and Balatok of the Philippine Islands, who had a San Francisco office. They could not do any more for me than accept my application. However, in the Philippines were six or seven Cal mining engineers who had gone there in the late 20s to work in the Philippine gold mines. So there was a choice. I really had a choice of three positions at the Spanish mine with the Bradleys, with the Goulds, or going to the Philippines. I selected, with a little pressure from Fred Bradley, perhaps he thought I would be of some help to Jim as manager, because I did know quite a bit about mining, having grown up in that atmosphere and started working around the mills and smelters and mines at an early age. The Spanish mine was located on the near a little village called Washington, which was located on the South Fork of the Yuba River, about 25 miles from Nevada City and about 5 miles from the Spanish mine. The Spanish mine had barely started operating when we were in trouble with metal prices, as this was 1931 and the Depression was advancing very rapidly on all mining activities as well as other forms of industry.
What was your position? What was your title at this time?
I was employed as assayer and served in that capacity for 2 or 3 months. Now I guess it is time to mention that the Bradley Mining Company started a laboratory, a metallurgical laboratory in Berkeley, and employed 3 or 4 metallurgists, each one of them assigned to an individual mine. The Spanish mine was assigned to a young man named Church Holmes, who was the metallurgist, and said what should be done about the milling.
This is at the university or in the town?
No, in the town, in just in lower Berkeley.
Okay.
D. Vedensky was assigned, I believe, to Bodie, which was an old mining camp, last operated by George Wingfield many years ago. But the Bradleys thought they could revive the operation and build a mill and develop the mine, which was over 10,000, which was about 10,000 feet elevation in the High Sierras. Another mine that they had signed a metallurgist to was at Atolia, a tungsten operation in the Randsburg, Southern California district. This plan of hiring a metallurgist to work out the details and then become mill superintendent sounded good on paper, but was not a practical approach. Church Holmes, who was running the Spanish mill from Berkeley, would come up and spend long weekends and a week or two in Nevada City and commute to the Spanish mine and make mill changes, thinking nothing of shutting down the mill while a pipeline was changed or a pump was installed or the flotation cells hooked up in a different manner. He had no understanding of what this did to production, as he was strictly understood in the metallurgical aspects. After
he had the authority, however, to do this.
He was in charge of the mill.
Now, as assayer, did you have any input on this at all?
Yes. In when the reports began reaching San Francisco about our low production and not very good metallurgy, Church Holmes was assigned to some other task, and I was made mill superintendent. Because of my former experience in Hayden and knowing considerably about flotation from studying it at Cal and visiting plants whenever I had an occasion. The Spanish mine shut down in just before Christmas due to the fact that our production of concentrates, which were from a very complex ore containing copper, lead, zinc, some gold and silver, and a high percentage of barite as a gang. Our objective was to make individual concentrates from these metals, except gold, which was jigged into a concentrate for shipment to Selby. Otherwise, all other shipments went to El Paso American Smelting Refining Company smelter. The last shipment we made was about the 1st of December, and we owed the mine owed the smelter for treating the concentrates instead of getting paid for the metal contained. This was the final straw, and the mine was shut down. I was asked to stay on and mothball the milling equipment and mining equipment, and then was offered a job at Yellow Pine in Idaho.
Would you mind saying, if you remember, how much you were paid at this time?
I don't know.
No.
I can tell that later, but...
Oh, right. I was also interested in what sort of living arrangements you had up at the mine.
Living arrangements were very primitive. I, being a college graduate, was a step above the others. Jim, the manager, had a small house which he lived in. I had a room over the general office, which was quite comfortable and large and suited me better than bunking with Jim. We all ate in the mine boarding house, so we had about 40 employees, as I recall.
Now, how was communication with San Francisco? Did you go through Jim on these things?
Oh, I didn't communicate with San Francisco.
You did?
You don't ever cut the manager out.
No
matter who he is.
But you registered your discontent with this mill situation
to Jim.
To Jim.
And let him take it up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
I was. Held against you, obviously.
Oh, no. No.
Mm-hmm.
I was. I had two men helping me mothball the equipment, which meant painting, greasing, be sure there was good drainage in all the floors and buildings, propping up some of the lean-tos, and just making it safe for winter.
You were hoping to reopen at a later time?
Yes. By then, the snows had come, and I was completely snowed in.
Mm.
We had one mule which I rode in to, from the mine to one mule to drag timbers around the yard, mine yard, and haul heavy loads that were necessary. And I rode him into Washington, where I got in touch with the Forest Service and asked if there's any way they could get me out with my car. So they said, we will give you a firm time in the 10 days and say when we're sending in the Caterpillar tractor, because there was a 2,000-foot drop between the highway on top of the ridge leading from Nevada City to the river, to the South Fork of the Yuba River, where Washington was located. Mm-hmm. So with the mule available to haul my car, pull my car from the Spanish mine to Washington, I then waited for this phone call, which came, and sure enough, the Caterpillar tractor was there to tow me up this long incline grade, and from there I was on my own. I did not accept the job at Yellow Pine because I heard that they were also snowed in, and I didn't want to go through this experience of snow again. So I decided I would go to Jackson, California, and work on the mother lode for a while.
Now, is this still with Bradley's?
No.
No.
The mother lode in Jackson, there was the Kennedy mine. I've forgotten the ownership, probably by a stock company, and the big Argonaut mine, which was owned as a stock company. I did know the manager, whose name was Swent. And the metallurgy was done by contract to Hamilton, Beecham, and Woodworth, an outstanding metallurgical firm located in San Francisco. I became friendly with Hamilton, and he put a word in for me with the general manager, and I was employed underground as a timberman's helper. I was not too fond of this particular assignment because the mine was what we call heavy ground, and the timbers were 16 inches in diameter, and they would snap like matchsticks after being under pressure with the swelling ground in the slate formation. I had accumulated money to buy assay office equipment, which...
Anytime you care to say what you were being paid at this time, this is of interest. Do you remember?
$3.50 a day.
As a timberman's helper?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And on that you were saving money?
No, I saved money working at the Spanish.
I see.
I spent all the money I saved at the, or I made at the Argonaut,
uh-huh,
because of buying this assay office equipment and opening up a custom assay office, which I thought would help me to get it in line with some good prospects in the area.
What sort of equipment did you buy?
Complete assay office.
Do you?
Oh yeah, it's too much detail.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Wondering where you bought it.
I bought it at a mine outside of Grass Valley that I knew of, and had it shipped and hauled it down by a friend's truck.
Mm-hmm.
rented a space and set it up and did quite a bit of assaying at nights when I wasn't working or in days when I was working nights. I finally decided there was something better for me to do with the Argonaut mine than become a miner's helper or timberman's helper and gradually work my way up at a slow pace. So so I went directly with the help of Hamilton, who was a Scot, and he, although with the firm, as previously mentioned, lived in Jackson and did the metallurgy at the Argonaut mine, which was most complicated because they had some carbon in the ore which precipitated the gold from cyanide solution. So he devised a new method, a method new at that time, of tumbling the concentrates by concentrates made by tabling or flotation with creosote oil, which coated the particles of sulfides and inhibited the dissolution inhibited the precipitation of the gold on the carbon. This was my first experience with carbonaceous material.
This was terribly important later.
Oh, right? Yes. I found a pretty good prospect on what was known as the West Belt of the Mother Lode near a little town called West Point. West Point was the furthest point west that Kit Carson came during his exploratory visits to the Western Mountains.
Now that's on the McColony, is it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. How'd you know that?
Well, I just happened to know it.
Yeah.
But I'm glad to know why West Point got its name. But
I
heard that.
I obtained a lease on the Golden Eagle Mine, mm-hmm, which seemed to have some promise, and two friends and myself had this lease on the mine, and I had a grub stake from working at the Argonaut, so I quit the mine, quit the Argonaut, and we started opening up this adit. The ore was formation was very hard. And when we had funds, we could use a jackhammer. But if we didn't have funds to run the compressor with fuel for the compressor, we did it by single jacking and double jacking.
Oh, my.
So our progress was slow, but we did hit one small pocket and took out a nice specimen of gold, the only one we found in the whole mine, and we sent it to Sacramento for the state fair and won a small prize.
Oh dear. Would you care to mention who your partners were in this?
that my two partners were the Irwin brothers.
David?
No.
No.
Homer was a mining, he graduated in mining geology. And his brother didn't go to college. They were very husky and very interested in their work, but would fight, really fight with fists and anything handy unless I was there to separate them. They just didn't seem to get along.
Were they from that area?
No, they were from Southern California. Mm. And this family sacrificed a great deal to send Homer on to college. And the last I knew of him, he died an alcoholic in South America at a mining camp.
Hmm.
Not too many years after he left Berkeley and particularly the Golden Eagle Mine.
Was drinking a problem at that time, Jim?
Not as long as I was there to handle him.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We all were quite...
Okay. You were quite assured.
Assured. And that isn't a good sentence.
You believed, I guess.
We believed that the price of gold was going to advance because it was higher in Europe than it was in the United States.
No,
the price of $20.67 had been established since the 1800s, 1700s. We can look that up because I have a...
long-standing.
Yeah. However, we ran out of money completely, and the only alternative was for me to borrow $25 from a friend of mine in Lodi, who was a fraternity brother, and go to Grass Valley and look for something new to do, look for a job.
You still had your assay shop, though.
I sold it.
You sold it.
Yes. And put it into the Golden Eagle.
Mm-hmm. How did you get news about the gold price in Europe? How were you aware of this sort of thing? Was it?
Oh, because of talking with the Argonaut and Kennedy people.
Yeah, this was, of course, something of great interest.
Sure, sure, it was down there.
I mean, in a normal town at that time, the gold price in Europe would not have been...
No.
That the man on the street would know.
The
if you want to wait just a second, I think we're at the end of the show,
are we?
So
all right.
Just, okay.
On the north end of the town of Jackson was a division of the town called Jackson Gate, which was the home of most of the miners working in the Argonaut and Kennedy. When one would drive through Jackson Gate or walk through Jackson Gate in the middle of the night, you could hear the little mills grinding away, which was high grade stolen from the mine. I went to Mr. Svent after I'd left the Argonaut and said, I would like the job of preventing the high grading from from going on in the mind, which I'm sure you are aware. He listened very carefully and to my plan, and having worked in the mind, I had some idea of the what was going on. However, he said, young man, you wouldn't live the week out if I gave you the job that you thought you wanted of stopping the high grading in this mine. He said, we all know what goes on, and there is nothing we can do about it but put up with it and hope the ore is sufficiently good grade to tolerate the losses.
My goodness. Now, did you work at all in the mill there?
No.
No.
But I used to visit a lot and knew the, because of knowing Hamilton, and also I met Woodward.
Selim Woodward?
Woodward, yes, I'd met him.
So, your career as a security officer was nipped in the bud.
Not then. I kept on till I put it to work.
This is, of course, a constant problem in mines and mills, isn't it? Or at least something you have to be aware of.
Yes, except Carlin.
Okay, we'll get to that later.
I decided that Grass Valley offered the best opportunity for a future to stay in the mining business. So on the $25 I borrowed from my good friend, Ralph Fitzsimmons, I went to Grass Valley talked the boarding house lady into giving me credit for a room and board, and then started making the rounds. I had known Mr. Fred Nobbs from my tenure at the Spanish Mine, because Jim and I both would come to town Saturday nights and were a part of the younger members of the Nobbs family and the Foote family, who was one of the principal owners and the manager of the North Star Mine, and he had three lovely daughters. So there was partying going on most Saturday nights. The Nobbs had three boys and one girl who were, of course, there in the summer when we were at the Spanish from May until they went away to school again. So not wanting to use my social
connections
with Fred Nobbs, I went to see him in his office, waiting in line with the what we called the rustlers, who were men forming a line at 6:30 in the morning to see the underground boss. I stepped aside just before I got to the underground boss and went up the steps and asked if I could see Fred Nobbs. This way I was not taking advantage of knowing him previously, because I had waited throughout the line for 30 minutes for my turn to come to put in an application. He said, "You're very fortunate, Frank. We need a man in the assay office and somebody with experience, flotation, that you have had at the Spanish mine, and you were assayer, and I understand a very good one, that from Jim Bradley, I understand you were a very good one at the Spanish, so we have an opening as assistant assayer, and it'll give you a chance to learn cyanidation." I said, "I accept the job without any qualifications or any
reservations.
I was paid," he said, "your pay is $5 a shift, not $150 a month, but $5 for the days I work." I said, "Thank you, that sounds like a lot of money, because I had to borrow money to get here." It turned out to be a very fortunate arrangement, because I had the assay office was located in the cyanide plant, and I had I was working for a man named Jim Trich.
Could you spell that?
T-R-I-C-H, who was a Stanford metallurgical graduate and went to school with Fred Nobbs at Stanford, and was probably one of the foremost cyanidation experts in the United States. He could have gone on to much bigger things than being the head assayer and metallurgist of the cyanide plant. However, he had three daughters growing up, and he would hit the bottle occasionally, which held him back, because sometimes he was in no shape to come to work. It didn't take too long for me to learn the fundamentals of cyanidation, working with him and having at least an hour to 2 hours every day for discussion of what took place in the cyanide plant. And then with the assay office located in the same building, I could wander from the end of our assaying shift to the end of the day's work through the cyanide plant and talk to the shift foreman and also to Arthur Dowdell, who was superintendent of the cyanide plant.
How was Dowdell spelled?
D-O-W-D-E-L-L. having had flotation as my first insight into milling ores at Hayden, Arizona, where flotation for copper ores was one of the early developments, and the Spanish mine where we floated copper, lead, and zinc, I was anxious to apply flotation to the Empire mill. The flow sheet used was stamps for crushing, amalgamation plates for the stamp mill discharge, and then shaking tables, Wolfley tables, for the concentration of sulfides. The recovery of gold was about 65% to 70% free gold in the form of amalgam, and the balance, 25%, was in the form of concentrates, which were piped to the cyanide plant. The table concentration was not too successful, but it was the best that they had conceived up until the time of flotation. So I diligently worked with flotation. I even got the company to buy small flotation cells and worked until I had developed a flow sheet, which was the forerunner of that used up and down the mother lode country. And and having developed a friendship with the American cyanide metallurgists, who were foremost in the leading group of world-renowned metallurgists, because they were the chemical company developing flotation reagents, I had considerable help and the loan of much equipment from them to, as they were trying to sell, at that time, the Fagergen flotation cell.
How is that spelled?
Fagergren.
Okay.
However, we also had the Kraut flotation cell.
K-R-A-U-T?
Yes, which was developed by Pan American Laboratory.
So you were doing research?
Yes, I was really doing research while I was working as assayer, and I soon became metallurgist for the for the Empire Mill, and then which was gradually enlarged to the North Star Mill, which at the Empire we milled 400 tons per day, and the North Star we milled about 300 tons a day.
And they had similar ore?
Yes, adjoining ores. Joining ore bodies or overlapping ore bodies. We soon went to flotation, bypassing tabling entirely, one small flotation unit in the stamp mill for treating half of the 400 tons per day occupied less than 5% of the area occupied by the tables and appropriate division of the cyanide plant.
Just a second, very well. So was there any, was there pressure from these companies that were selling equipment?
Oh, great competition.
Okay. Did they put pressure on you in any way that influenced your research?
No, no. They couldn't do enough for me. It was no pressure. It was just the opposite. As pressure.
Was it, there was competition
among
the company?
Yes, among the companies, but that meant they couldn't put pressure. Is this on you?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to hear this.
Yeah, I do.
No, there was no pressure whatsoever because the sales organization for the Kraut cells and the Denver sub-A cells and the Fagerden cell, they were in competition, so they were trying to do favors for you, mm-hmm. but not with pressure. And then there was Dow Chemical Company, American Cyanide Company, and DuPont developing flotation reagents. The Dow Chemical Company were the developers principally of the xanthates, which were the early reagents used in copper metallurgy in the 1915-1920 period.
Well, Wellesley must have been unhappy when you cut out their tables.
Well, that was just natural evolution.
They didn't
take up huge space. And
they didn't
not,
pressure you. No,
into no,
using
no,
them?
No. They turned to. They developed a fine pump, and oh no, I had good friends in Wellesley. I was.
Excuse me. I wanted to ask one more thing. At this time, were there old things like conventions and meetings and things that you were attending?
No, I was too junior.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you weren't getting wined and dined?
No, no.
By these people?
No.
Okay, so
I was made metallurgist for the Empire Star mines. But only those under Fred Knobs. There was a manager who was quite a rival named Robert Hendricks, rival to Fred Knobs, and he had his operation, which I was called upon to assist, but did not have direct authority. That's because you tape over it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I don't like on these. I have one like that, and I don't like it for that reason.
No. Well.
Because of the progress I made for developing a system of milling the gold ores of Empire and North Star and other mines and other neighboring mines of Newmont, I was given the job of developing a research laboratory for Newmont. This was independent of Empire Star, but still we had their backing and cooperation. There was a very fine building at the North Star mine, which was taken over for the metallurgical laboratory, completely equipped, and ore started coming in from Canada, Mexico, South America, and different places for test purposes. And I had a small crew to assist me in doing this work, and an assayer to do the assaying. This later became Newmont's central laboratory located in Danbury, Connecticut, which now does all of the metallurgy for all of Newmont mines the world over. They have about 20 metallurgists and 20 supporting staff.
Where did the initiative come for this? Was this a suggestion that you made?
always pushing.
Uh-huh. You made this suggestion?
Oh, yes.
To whom?
Fred Searles.
Fred, where was he at this time?
Fred in Newmont, New York.
He was in New York, and how did you see him? How did you communicate with
he
him?
He came out and visited all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you had a chance to talk to him?
I'd make a chance to talk to him.
Uh-huh.
My pay during this period was $5 a day. I think I mentioned that before, didn't I?
Well, that was what that you were hired at. You hadn't gotten a raise.
Oh, during the early period was $5. Here's something that was rather interesting. After I had been in the Empire cyanide plant and assay office for a reasonable period of time, I went to see Fred Nobbs to ask for a raise in pay, pointing out some of the achievements that I had accomplished. Nobbs pulled out a folder from his desk about 2 inches thick and said, "Frank, here are over 100 applications from engineers all over the world. They would all consider it a privilege to live in Grass Valley and work for the Empire Star." I replied, "Thank you, Mr. Nobbs. I hope you don't dock me for the time I spent coming to see you.
Oh. Well, those were hard times, weren't
oh,
they?
Oh, yeah.
This is 34 now?
This, 34, 35. Mm-hmm. During this early period of 1934, I married Frances Hazeltine because I had a job with not bad pay for that time of $5 and had an opportunity of working weekends for which I was paid.
Mm-hmm. At the same place, overtime.
Yeah, overtime. We came back from being married on a weekend in San Francisco, and Fred Nobbs had heard from his sons and daughter that Frank McQuiston had gotten married, so he called me in and said, I want you to take a week off with pay for a honeymoon. We had no money for a honeymoon, so we went visiting mines where I knew people well enough that we might stay with them or get a free meal. We went back to Jackson and visited with friends there. Then we went to the Comstock Lode where Phil Bradley had an operation of working over the one of the old dumps by cyaniding the ores and tailings. Then we went to Nevada City and stayed with friends, which wasn't much of a honeymoon because it was only 4 miles from where we were living. We lived in a rented room on the third floor of an old Victorian house and took our meals at the boarding house where I had boarded before getting married. And then Fran found a very nice little bungalow of 5 rooms in a nice court with wide open spaces around it for $35 a month, which left us $100. Or other for living expenses. All Grass Valley was full of engineers because the Idaho, Maryland, the Spring Hill, the Lavacap, the Empire, the North Star, and one or two, and the Empress, and one or two smaller mines were all running full blast because of the increased price of gold from $20 to $35, almost doubling the price. So it was a boom time for the gold mine. I could go on forever because I wrote this book on this chapter here, but mm-hmm. We can't do that. We'll refer them to the book. During this time, let's see, it was in 1936. Noble Getchell, Getchell, a state senator and mining entrepreneur, and formerly profitable operator of the Midas and Betty O'Neill mines in Nevada, grub-staked two prospectors who decided they would look for some kind of gold deposit northeast of Winnemucca. They took the grub stake that Noble Getchell had given them. You know what that is, a grub stake.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And after doing a little wandering around, bought 2 gallons of whiskey at Red House, Nevada, which was the railroad siding on the Western Pacific Railroad. After they drank the whiskey, they decided they had better go back to Reno and, but did not dare face Noble Getchell without some samples. So there was almost a cliff of outcrop with a reddish and orange coloring. So they knocked off chunks of that, filled their sample sacks, and went back to Reno. The assays showed a fair gold content. And Noble Getchell went out himself and took other samples and found that they, over quite a wide area, were very good gold values. So a strike had definitely been made. Noble Getchell was a great friend of George Wingfield. Neither one of them had any money. However, because George Wingfield, who had owned 12 banks, First National Banks of Nevada, had gone through bankruptcy during the bank, what do you call it?
Failures.
During the bank failure, and he had no money. However, his old friend, Barney Baruch, whom he knew in Goldfield, had always told him that I will give you $1 million for any gold, for any mine you ever want to invest in. So just let me know of the time and the place. Mm-hmm. So George Wingfield telephoned Barney Baruch in New York, and Barney says, I'll send you a check for $1 million. George Wingfield said, no, I will not accept it until you have an engineer examine this mine, this prospect that we have. Barney Baruch said, all right, I'll send Fred Searles out. Fred Searles was in Africa, and by the time he settled his business there and came from South Africa to, want me to quit?
We're just about at the end of the tape. If you want to just wait a second, you can. Always takes a little longer than you think.